This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome back, everybody, to the People Who Speak radio show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Who Speak show normally airs every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have a virtual radio room, the People Speak radio show, that anyone may participate to join the show. This is a fantastic show tonight. I'm more excited than Gene Rosen getting his first Oscar nomination. We're talking to a very special guest right here, a controversial researcher, an inspiring truther, and a renowned political commentator. He's the editor of the website Memory Hole Blog at www.memoryholeblog.com. and the host of Real Politic Radio on Truth Frequency Radio. We are talking tonight to Professor James Tracy, formerly of Florida Atlantic University. Welcome to the People Who Speak radio show, Professor Tracy, sir.
Well, thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
It's always awesome to have you, sir, and we'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you is, why on earth would a university freak out so much about what things you do in your own spare time?
Well, that's a very good question. There's a real contrast between what my former employer, Florida Atlantic University, did in terms of my free speech off campus in 2013 versus more recently when a letter, an opinion piece was published by the South Florida Sun Sentinel, authored by a Veronique and Lenny Posner, alleging that I was harassing them simply because I was responding to them. They had filed a copyright infringement claim against my blog. Actually, it was Lenny Posner and his Honor Network, H-O-N-R Network, back in March of 2015. I sent a certified letter to Lenny Posner and his Honor Network at their Newtown, Connecticut address, which is actually a postal box service, and asking for proof, for evidence, that he was in fact the owner of the image in question, which had been circulated throughout the mass media, throughout the world. And I was simply acting within the parameters of fair use and expressed that as well. I expressed in my letter to Posner back in spring of 2015 that his actions, not only against me, but against many other researchers into the Sandy Hook event, both on YouTube and their own blogs, they were getting these copyright infringement claims, and I asserted to him that this was really an assault on free speech, on the right for citizens, individuals, to be able to question, to query controversial events, and to call out anomalies in them, and to really, you know, overall seek redress of our grievances with our government. That's what it really comes down to, and that's the essence of free speech, and that's all that I think myself and any others were doing who've called Sandy Hook or any other controversial events into question. It's not a matter of harassing anyone. The Sandy Hook parents, including the Posners, are voluntarily public figures. They voluntarily provided these documents, these photographs, to the news media. They can be used for reportage that is positive or negative, and they can be used for commentary or criticism, which is, again, within the boundaries of fair use. So that, in a nutshell, is what took place. Now, the media took their opinion piece, again published on December 10th in the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and they bracketed off the whole question of free speech and the copyright infringement claims that Posner's group had been filing against not only my blog, but a host of others, getting YouTube channels closed down, you know, no trial, no jury, no nothing. There were ISPs that were also contacted by His Honor Network, and they were compelled to take down images. All of this, again, I see as being a real threat to free speech, to our right to be able to inquire and question controversial events, acts by our governments, and so forth.
And of course, that's very, very important that we do have the ability to ask these questions. Isn't that true?
Well, absolutely. And I think one of the things that the powers that be are doing, and I do believe there's a connection here between the larger forces and these individual actors who have, you know, published these this defamatory letter, for example, in the South Florida Sun Sentinel. What they're trying to do is use copyright in order to shut down speech and inquiry into these various events. And this is being done in the United States. It's being done over in Europe now. If you've seen the news today, the fact that there's a European court that is actually, they are hearing a case that will determine whether or not linking to blogs or to websites that have copyrighted material that might not have received copyright clearance is something that is legally actionable. So this is something that will eventually going to, you know, come over to our shores as well. It's tested over there, and it could very well be a provision under something like the TPP or another trade agreement. So these things are, you know, they're more than on the horizon. You know, they're approaching us very quickly, and I think that's one instance of that here that's affected me in a very personal way. My university has gone ahead and terminated my employment. We can talk about that, you know, for the remainder of this the program whenever you wish. But they did not do it on free speech grounds. They didn't do it on the grounds of academic freedom. It was something completely different from that.
But one thing I noted when I did a bit of background research is you faced a firestorm of backlash over your research and your comments. Is it not worth noting that even Noah Posner's grandmother has been calling to, quote, crack down on truthers, unquote, in the Jewish media newspapers? I mean, why would anybody be opposed to seeking the truth about a topic, do you think?
Well, I think that they're actually somewhat frightened because there have been tens of millions of dollars that have been taken in the form of donations to these families. The low estimate is around $25 million. There are higher estimates upwards of $100 million or more. And this research is revealing a great deal, not only what I've done. There have been a host of very good and astute researchers who have delved into and found all sorts of anomalies, conflicting information. The police, you know, the official reports don't add up, and we can go on and on and on about that. But my feeling is that the parties involved immediately in this case and who are likely overseeing this event, and not to mention events such as Boston, have taken in a tremendous amount of money. And if this actually were investigated in a thorough and professional way, which it could be if we had honest courts and honest law enforcement officials, we would likely find fraud at a tremendous degree. And this, therefore, would lead to them having to return that money to those that have contributed it.
Gosh, it's all about the dollars. Just follow the cash and you'll find the corruption right behind it. The listeners would like to know, what are you doing about your dismissal, if you can talk about that at all?
Well, I can't talk about it a great deal because of simply because this is something that I am actively working on with my attorney, and so I can simply talk about what has been reported in the media and seek to correct much of that reportage, which is disparaging, to say the least. So that's one of the reasons that I'm here this evening. But as far as particulars With any prospective case, I cannot even say as to whether or not a lawsuit will be filed. But we are examining the facts and collecting those. And so I have to more or less leave it at that. Now, I was appointed an attorney by the faculty union shortly after this whole thing went down and after the university announced that they were poised to terminate me back in mid-December. And I worked with that attorney up through early to mid-January. We did not see eye to eye on a number of things, and I thought that I could probably get a stronger advocate by hiring an independent counsel, and that's what I ultimately did. So the university, or excuse me, the union's policy is that if you do seek or retain counsel out of pocket, then we will, you know, retreat from the scene, and we will no longer provide the funding for your counsel. But that's the route that I've taken. I'm satisfied with that. I have established a legal defense fund as well, and that is to a large degree how I am financing the legal representation at this time.
So in essence, what were the official grounds for your firing from the university, and what role, if any, did the Posners play in making that happen?
Well, if you look at their opinion piece, again, that was published December 10th in the Sun Sentinel, it was a roadmap. It was a set of directions. It was a set of rationale for why James Tracy should be fired and on what grounds he should be terminated. And I think that there was also a public relations campaign that was headed up in part by Posner and his Honor Network, who are really more or less, if you look somewhat closely at their activities, they are online stalkers. They are the ones who are stalking and harassing me, even though they claim that I am stalking and harassing them. This is a clear case of projection, and I have ample evidence of that. They've done that with a number of parties that I know. They've ruined their personal businesses. They've ruined the reputations of these targeted individuals. And they've done the same to me in terms of the relationship with my employer. So that's something that I think is – now, they also had a tremendous amount of help with the press. You mentioned a Jewish publication. South Florida have a very strong and tightly knit Jewish American community. Opinion piece that the Posners wrote for the Sun Sentinel on December 10th was republished the following day by the Jewish Forward, which is the most well-known ethnic Jewish publication in the United States. And there were a great many comments on that post at the Jewish Forward. But I am told by those that sought to defend me on that publication's website, their comments were scrubbed. They were taken off. Or if they sought to provide factual information concerning the Sandy Hook event and my role in the event, their comments were expunged from the comments section on a number of occasions, and there's evidence of this as well. And there's evidence of this having been done at the Sun Sentinel, too. So this is something I would contend whereby the media are actively involved in presenting this whole event of my termination and the events leading up to it in a particular way, and it is something that is intentional and is willful on their behalf.
Now, anyone who's done any inch of study into the Sandy Hook hoax will have by now heard your name. Except for the trolls and the sock puppets and the mindless stooges, what kind of responses and feedback have you had from people supporting you in general?
I have had a good deal of positive support. You mentioned the sock puppets, the trolls. There's a flurry of emails that I received at my fau.edu email address in early to mid-December, profane, in some cases death threats and things of the like. And I think that this in part is a psychological operation. Now, some of those are probably spontaneous and sincere, but I would imagine that others are being done by the trolls and the sock puppet accounts and things of the like. But the emails and the support that I have received from colleagues and from those that frequent my blog and who are acquainted with me or who know me, all of those things have been very heartening. And in a situation like this, you really get to know who your friends are and who those who actually do support you. It's a matter of sort of winnowing away between people who are sincere and who do understand you and what you in fact stand for as well, versus those that that do not. They may be misinformed. I think there are a great many faculty and even organizations that purportedly stand up for free speech. They are misinformed. They are ignorant, or they are fearful of taking a stand for me. Because of being smeared themselves, because of the fear of possibly being smeared. And it was a very vicious campaign that contributed to my termination, I believe, and it's something that I think was quite professionally done. But to get back to your question, yeah, I have received a good deal of support thus far, and I think that once the facts do emerge and the information, and if the public is actually afforded that information and able to digest it, they will understand my side of the argument, and I would like to think that they would support me in my side as well, and in my fight in this overall scenario and what's taken place.
Well, it's good to hear that people are supporting you. Thank goodness for that. Now, just this morning, the researcher who managed to get the 1 terabyte of FOIA requests, who gave that terabyte of information to Rebecca Roth, a.k.a. Monica Gaynor, a.k.a. Ashley Noorani, whatever her name is, he mentioned that he'd like you personally to take a look at the data. Would you be interested in that at all?
Now, is this information pertaining to Sandy Hook?
Oh, this is 9/11 information pertaining to the flight data from the early morning of 9/11.
Yeah, this is new to me. I'd certainly be happy to take a look at the information, sure.
Because it's very technical, I believe, and a lot of people just don't get what's being said in the information. So somebody of your tenure and somebody of your stature would surely have a field day with this kind of information.
Well, I'd be happy to consider looking at it. Yeah, I'm not sure if that is my particular forte. 9/11 itself is such a complex event. There are so many facets of it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
What state is the country in, do you think, where a professor cannot critically speak about important topics that happened today? What state of the country do you think we're in right now?
Well, tenure is something that is supposed to shield scholars, intellectuals, from controversy and allow them to examine events, issues, and the like, unmolested by the broader public, without interference by a sensationalistic press and public opinion that can frequently be easily swayed through headlines and through tweets and, you know, sound bites. And unfortunately, only about 1/4 to 1/3 of faculty in the United States actually do have tenure. So that means that 2/3 to 3/4 of faculty are on year-to-year contracts, or they are independent contractors in the sense that they are adjunct instructors and they teach one course and they get a contract for that and it has to be renewed. This contributes to all sorts of things like grade inflation and pleasing the students without actually challenging them to learn and to discover things in part for themselves and to develop those types of talents. All of these things, I think, are a threat to tenure. But if you have an individual who is sincerely delving into a topic as a citizen, but also as a media critic, and if his institution is going to terminate him without looking at the evidence, without looking at facts, without looking at the information, and without considering or tendering his or her arguments, then I think that we're in a very, very sorry state. And that's exactly what has taken place. The FAU administration has never cared to consider any of my arguments. They are simply concerned with public relations, good public relations, and they have sought to reprimand not only me, but a number of other faculty members since 2014 with the installation of John Kelly, who is FAU's present president. His administration has gone to extremes to let faculty know that they cannot speak out of turn. If they do, they will face reprimand, possibly, given my example, up to and including termination. This is something that actually came to the fore in a very contentious Faculty Senate meeting in September of 2015, where a number of faculty members, FAU faculty members, my colleagues, most of them in political science, took issue with their colleagues and other faculty at FAU who were receiving letters, threatening letters and emails from the vice president for public affairs, who was the right-hand man to John Kelly. And at the same time, they were seeking to eliminate tenure effectively through a post-tenure review process that was very draconian. I actually had that sound file linked in a post that I wrote for my blog, as well as a global research, commenting on this post-tenure review process, which was going to essentially allow administrators to fire faculty, more or less, but also as a side issue. These professors that were gathered at this Faculty Senate meeting back last fall or late last summer brought up the issue of the administration issuing these letters to faculty members who may have just it's not as if they were actually even delving into controversial events per se as I was doing, but simply saying something that the administration didn't care for in terms of the spin, in terms of how it might reflect on the university. So they've taken a very, very clear stance in terms of only positive public relations, nothing negative. But, you know, in academe, some of the things, actually, I believe that academics should delve into controversial events and should address those things. Who else is going to do that if we don't? Can you expect Fox News or CNN to delve into something like that? Most salaried journalists are not going to do it. And so it is left to the only salaried intellectuals left that do have protections are scholars, are university faculty. And frankly, I don't believe that a majority of university faculty actually do exercise tenure in the way that it was intended. And that's terribly unfortunate. I think that if we just had if we had a handful of scholars delving into, say, these deep events, as Peter Dale Scott terms them, this world, this country would certainly be a different place. You mentioned 9/11 earlier. Take, for example, Noam Chomsky. Think about what he's done in terms of the search for truth of 9/11 and what took place at that event. He completely sidetracked the entire progressive left, And he did it with the book that he came out shortly after that event. But it shouldn't surprise us, because he was the same way with regard to majority of the significant political assassinations throughout the 20th century, including JFK and RFK, refusing to actually address those. And so I think there's a real disingenuousness among tenured faculty in the United States, in particular social scientists and those in the humanities, that choose to tout things like LGBT as being somehow transgressive and radical, when it's really nothing of the sort, as far as I'm concerned. It's, in fact, it's something that's accepted by the establishment. I would say that there are some faculty members who do take up the cause of the Palestinian people against the state of Israel. I do think that that is noble. But that's one of the few issues that I can actually really think of off the top of my head that is controversial, that many faculty will take up. And so it's very concerning. And I think that many faculty, I can say this as a matter of fact, because I know many faculty members, both at FAU and elsewhere, are frightened. They realize that they have a good thing in terms of a secure employment in a very precarious economy. And so they are reluctant to rock the boat. And they are much more inclined to take up a seat at a neocon think tank or the equivalent, which will further their career, regardless of whether or not what they are actually espousing and furthering is truthful and factual. They're more concerned with being comfortable. And I don't want to paint with too wide of a brush here. But overall, I'm afraid that that's the case. And that does not bode well for the United States. It doesn't bode well for free speech or for a society that seeks to be free.
In that line of thinking, there's a very famous saying that goes, first they came for the academics. Now, do you feel that the United States or the USA is slipping into a Nazi Germany mentality with this kind of lack of freedom of thought?
Unfortunately, I'm inclined to think that that's the case.
Oh, wow.
The media are so effective, I think, with the majority of the population. Not everyone. There are people, for example, who listen to your program, who listen to other alternative independent media. But there is a, I think that there is this power of the narrative, which is so effective among those who are already somewhat entranced through the likes of their Twitter feed or Facebook, the social media, or the television news media. Again, really absorbing their what they deem to be reality through headlines and sound bites, and not looking at the multidimensional reality out of which all events and the like actually proceed and emerge. And so this power of the narrative is evident in something like a Sandy Hook or a Boston or the Umpqua Community College shooting in Oregon or the San Bernardino shooting. And we could see this as well in other types of deep controversial events, such as the major political assassinations of the 1960s, whereby a narrative emerges and is reinforced and is driven home by the mainstream media, say, so for example, like Lee Harvey Oswald or Sirhan Sirhan. Any of the more Timothy McVeigh. And this is something, the narrative becomes the reality, even though there are a variety of contradictions, of anomalies in that narrative. Factual information does not add up. And yet the narrative is what is overarching and what in many ways, unfortunately, determines our reality. It determines public policy. It determines the given political regime and what types of policies it is going to pursue. So it's all-encompassing, And it is of tremendous significance that the majority of the media in the United States are controlled by a handful of companies, depending on which studies you look at. Four or five companies control a majority of what we see, what we hear. The boards of directors of those companies can fit into a moderate-sized room. That's a tremendous amount of power to have. In fact, that's more significant than political power because it determines the narratives that the given political regimes and forces will actually use and in order to pursue their own types of agendas and further those. You have, as I was mentioning a short while ago, you do have individuals such as scholars who could contest these things. We do now have alternative media and blogs and the like, and yet these are very small efforts in comparison to the to the bullhorn that the major media possess. They're the largest voice on the block, right?
And so
if someone such as myself that does have or did have professional status and might call into question these things, then of course that person has to be shouted down. That's what happened to me back in early 2013. That's what happened to me in late 2015 as well, which culminated in the university terminating my employment. I think this kind of goes back to the earlier portion of our discussion. Me as an example, faculty members look at that and they understand that they can only go so far. And they dare not be called a quote-unquote conspiracy theorist because that's something that's, right around the corner could be their own livelihood.
Well, please stick with us, sir. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with special guest Professor James Tracy live on Internet Radio on the BBS Radio Network. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to the People Who Speak radio show, coming to you live across America and across the world in real time. We're back tonight with our guest. He's a professor, a political analyst, and a prolific speaker on the fake gun attacks being used to curb free speech and remove Americans' rights. Welcome back there, Professor Tracy, sir.
Happy to be back for the second half hour.
I do believe we have a caller on the line. Are you there, caller? Can you tell us where, what your name is and where you're from? And hit us with your question.
My name is Michael. I'm from Illinois. How are you doing?
Hi, fine, thanks.
I just wanted to say, okay, in the U.S., they tend to use more indirect means to censor people. You know, they do it through various organs. It's not through the law. In Europe, there are laws in place that make the questioning of a certain event in particular illegal, and I wanted to know what your thoughts were on Holocaust revisionism.
Well, I haven't done any research myself into that event, but it is certainly a potential threat to academic freedom to put shackles on any researcher or scholar who's looking into the facts, no matter what they what the event may be. And so I know that in 13 countries throughout the world, someone can be can be incarcerated for raising certain questions, for examining certain types of events. That one in particular, there is the example of Nick Colostrum, who was in England, who was dismissed from his university position for publishing a book that included forensic evidence concerning the event. So it's something that is it's a reality today, unfortunately. And I think that, you know, in the first half of the program, we were talking about narratives and the significance of narratives themselves. And here we have an historical narrative that cannot be questioned. What I've been doing is simply questioning more current, recent narratives, such as Sandy Hook, such as Boston. And contrary to what a lot of the media claim, that I'm just some sort of a babbling fool who points his finger and says that everything is a hoax, that's not the case at all. I've always encouraged my readers, like I have encouraged my students, to think for themselves, to look at the events, look at the facts pertaining to particular events, and make up their own minds. I think that there's this notion of university professors somehow being behind the lectern, and there's a kind of a mind control operation going on where students simply need to regurgitate everything that they're told. But a good educator does not do that. A good educator cultivates the critical thinker that's inherent in every human being, in every individual. And it's simply a matter of looking at the facts, whether it's, again, an historical event, whether it's something that's more current. And that's something that I've always done. I've never been dogmatic. And I think that everyone that's familiar with my work will attest to that. That I've never sought to drive home points and say that there's no other way of looking at this. There are plenty of ways of looking at controversial events in particular. And in a free society, we should be able to do that. Scholars and journalists should not fear being able to do that. But I think that Michael is right, the caller is right, in that in the United States it's more furtive than is the case in many other countries, including the country to our north in Canada, where there are laws on the books that put certain types of events out of bounds and not up for any type of debate. That in and of itself is something that is anti-intellectual in my view.
Thanks very much for your question there, caller.
There would just
Thank
be
you.
Thank you.
Okay, we got a question from Rob in the UK. Why do you think the school, we're talking about Sandy Hook School, was knocked down?
Well, the same reason that the Murrah Federal Building was knocked down just several weeks after the Oklahoma City bombing. It was destroyed to get rid of forensic evidence that would have called into question the event. And he could say the same thing about the Lanza home, the home of Nancy and Adam Lanza, where they apparently lived. That was also leveled by the city of Newtown. And in fact, the construction workers that were involved in the demolition of the Sandy Hook Elementary School facility had to sign forms that they would not, non-disclosure forms, that they would not divulge anything in terms of the remnants, in terms of what they observed during the demolition process, which is pretty amazing and rather telling in my view.
Absolutely. We have a question from Carol in Australia. Why do you think it is so many people still don't think for themselves and blindly follow the official narration in cases like Sandy Hook? Is it intellectual laziness? Is it cognitive dissonance? Or simply, they just don't care either way?
Unfortunately, I think it's a combination of all those things. Of course, it depends on the individual. It's simply too disturbing, in some cases, to think that one's own government might be involved in some of these events. It's much easier to actually take the prevailing narrative. Think about the type of peer pressure and social pressure that is also involved. It's not as if I go to a family function personally, or a faculty function, or a social gathering and begin talking about these events, because most people really don't care to discuss them. They find questioning them disturbing. So this is something that is not foreign to me. It's something that is pervasive in our culture, and there is, I think, a tendency. In fact, this is something that's been upheld in a variety of well-known social scientific studies. There is a tendency towards conformity and not rocking the boat, and people. I think a majority of people, most all of us, really. Want to be accepted. They want to be loved by their peers, by their family, by their close associates. They want to be accepted professionally in their workplace. And so, raising these types of questions will get one labeled
ostracized.
And ostracized. So there's a price to pay for critical thinking. Fortunately, there is the internet, and people now, I think more so than ever, can find themselves in friendly forums, chat groups, in comment sections. There's a whole community on my blog that exchange a variety of perspectives. I don't agree with all of them, but I think in the spirit of free speech and free exchange, they should be voiced and contested. And it goes back to John Milton's Areopagitica, that the truth can be attained only in a cacophony of conflicting perspectives and views. And even if an argument is incorrect, and even if it is flawed, we want to hear that argument articulated, because that's a sounding board for an argument that might be more truthful, that might be more valid, and more rational. And It is unfortunate, but this goes back again to an earlier portion of our discussion, where the narrative is something that is enforced by the media, and it is something that the majority of people unfortunately adopt to. It also, I think, has to do with not only lazy citizens, lazy readers of news media, but also lazy journalists and lazy news media themselves that do not, or are not allowed, perhaps by their editors or the owners of the given media enterprises, to delve into these events that some of which are quite dubious.
Right, right. We do have another caller in. We have Mike from California. Go ahead there, Mike, with your question for Professor James Tracy.
Yes, I was wondering if Professor Tracy had heard of Professor Stephen Salata at the University of Illinois, who was fired in 2014 for condemning the attacks of Israel on Gaza in a tweet on Twitter. And he recently won $875,000 in a lawsuit, but he won't be reinstated at the university.
Yes, I am familiar with that case. And one of the differences between Professor Salaita's case and mine is that he was an assistant professor. It's my understanding that he was just appointed as assistant professor, whereas I have been at Florida Atlantic University for 13 years. I'd been there since 2002. I was granted tenure in 2008. All of my annual evaluations are stellar, above satisfactory to excellent in every area, teaching, research, and service. And so my termination is completely disproportionate with the alleged offense of not filling out outside employment or activity forms. That's one of the main differences. But the essence of free speech, or the seeking to quell speech of a faculty member that might be deemed controversial, I think that is an aspect that is definitely consistent between his case and mine.
Right, right. Any other questions there, Mike?
No, that's it. Thank you very. Although I think it does say he was tenured. If I read it correctly.
Okay.
It says it's $875,000 is 10 times the annual salary he would have received as a tenured professor in the American Indian Studies program. Okay.
Yes, and I believe that he did obtain a position. An equivalent position in Beirut, if I'm not mistaken, at another university overseas. So he had no trouble getting back on his feet. But it was certainly, I think, an injustice that Illinois served on him.
Well, thanks very much for your question there, Mike.
For you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We do have a question from Winston Smith in Hawaii. That says, Professor Tracy at one point sent a registered letter to the parents of supposed massacre victim child Noah Posner. Is it true that you did, and you demanded that there to prove that their son existed?
Not exactly, and we talked about this at the outset of the program, but it's an important point to clarify, and I appreciate the question and being able to really explain what took place, because that's a lot more than almost all mainstream outlets actually did when this event transpired between mid-December and early to mid-January. The Lenny Posner and his honor network is not Noah Posner. I think that's what the question stated. But Lenny Posner, who is the father of the deceased child Noah Posner at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, sent my internet service provider a copyright infringement claim under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in March of 2015. I believe it was March 23rd or 25th of 2015. I received this via email through my ISP, which is Automattic, which is based in San Francisco. They are the parent company of WordPress.com that houses my blog at present. And the representative from Automattic sided with me and said, we don't believe that you need to take this down because this is fair use as far as we're concerned, and we're not going to take it down. But if you want to, that's fine. And there's actually a formal process for appealing this that would open one up to possible litigation by the person that claims copyright ownership. What I did in lieu of that was send a certified letter, and this is something that you can also access online, including my site, asking for evidence, forensic evidence, that the party this Lenny Posner and his Honor Network that were claiming ownership of the photograph, of the image, substantiate that? Because he had filed this complaint under penalty of perjury that this was, in fact, his image, that he owned this. Well, this has been circulating all over the internet. In fact, it reemerged in Peshawar, Pakistan on December 16th of 2014 following a school massacre there of this image allegedly of Noah Posner, that he had died there as well. So a lot of people yes. online began saying, well, it looks as if Noah Posner passed away twice. You know, he was involved in two massacre events. So there, even the BBC, after circulating that image, acknowledged that that was the image that was that emerged in the wake of the Sandy Hook massacre almost 2 years prior. So this is why I was curious, why I wanted to know from the Posner Party and his organization, Honor Network. And I did not send it to Lenny and Veronique Posner. I was not harassing the family. I was sending it to his nonprofit organization, Honor Network, and to his address, which is actually to a postal box rental place in Newtown, Connecticut. I sent it certified, and an agent of Lenny Posner, it wasn't even him that signed for it, it was his agent, whoever that might be, signed for the letter, and I had stated in the letter, among other things, that I wanted proof that he was, in fact, the copyright holder. I also remarked that this is something that potentially violates free speech, the right of any individual to question an event, doesn't matter if it's Sandy Hook or anything else. These individuals, many of the families involved in the Sandy Hook massacre, are public figures voluntarily. They have released these images out to the public realm, and they can be used for any type of purpose. They can be used for news reportage coverage, or they can be used for criticism and commentary, which is exactly what the fair use provision of the Copyright Act in the U.S. states.
We have a question from Auntie Kate in Australia. Were there mass funerals following Sandy Hook? Were there mass funerals at all? Did we see that anywhere?
Well, majority of them were closed casket. One exception was the Posner's funeral that was not closed casket. That was open casket. Although the access to the event itself was seriously restricted. And this is something that was reported on by news media in the Posner funeral, the others. But majority of them were closed casket. And I think that's one of the questions that is raised when people are delving into and questioning, you know, the facts surrounding this event. Well, there were funerals. Well, yes, there were. In fact, the majority of the funerals were overseen by one particular funerary consortium there in the area of Newtown. That's an area that's really not been delved into terribly closely. It deserves further scrutiny by the research community.
Absolutely. We have a question from Earthplay in New Mexico. Do you, Professor James Tracy, see much hope on the horizon as far as people waking up to what a scam is going on in the world?
I think that there is hope. Maybe that contradicts to a certain degree some of my earlier observations in this hour. But one thing that we can point to now, something that is affecting everyone in the industrialized and developed world, is the economic crisis that's unfolding throughout the world. If you look at what took place over in the exchanges, the stock exchanges in Japan yesterday, the TOPIX and the Nikkei fell 5%, in excess of 5% each. And this is something that looks as if it may very well be headed towards meltdown mode. If or when that does take place later this year, I think that there will be a real reckoning in terms of the whole kind of political economy of the world. And at that time, hopefully, the people and or leaders that actually do have integrity can come forward with economic alternatives. We've seen this take place in Iceland, where bankers are being banned. And I think that really a lot of this, the types of subterfuges that are taking place, the media events that are contrived, many of them really do have a financial basis. And so I do see cause for potential optimism with this this pending economic crisis. You know, there's going to be a great deal of chaos, and out of this, perhaps we'll have something along the lines of an Iceland scenario taking place globally. But I think there's going to be an awful lot of confusion and real torment and suffering as a result of something that was propped up back in 2008 and 2009 by largely phony means through central banks. And that is going to be something that it's coming apart right now. And so it will be interesting to see how things unfold. Now, that said, this requires a population, a polity, that is actually aware of what is going on, that is aware of the central banks as the underlying force, underlying the type of capitalism that we have in the world today. Whether or not people actually do understand that is something else entirely. And this, I think, goes back in part to the failure of the academy and the failure of our right. educational institutions, at least here in the United States.
Right. I did want to get more into the fact that Noah Posner appeared in Pakistan, but we are running out of time. We've got about 60 seconds. Last question from English Rob. Do you think maybe Noah Posner, having died twice, is the baby Jesus?
I, despite the this notion that I had harassed the Posner family, I think I've always been quite careful about addressing that whole issue. If you do read the posts that I did put up early in January of 2015 about that whole inconsistency, I think that it bears that out. I don't think that he is.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for that honest question. We have run out of time. Unfortunately, we got to get you on again. I've still got a dozen or more questions. Thank you very much, Professor Tracy, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be on, and thank you to your listeners.
Awesome. You've been listening to the People Speak Radio Show with special guest Professor James Tracy. I'd like to thank him and remind all the listeners to visit his website at www.memoryholeblog.com or listen to him on the Real Politics Show on Truth Frequency Radio. Join us coming up soon on the People Speak Show when I talk with Bali Bombings researcher Robert S. Finnegan and Australian researcher PK22. Stay tuned for those interviews coming soon. Big thanks go out to the producers Mike, Doug, and Donald, and to all my friends throughout the world and all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there.